Good evening.
Good evening.
I'm very happy to be here, very truly. I'd like to jump in immediately, carrying on a thread that seems to have been developed by John this morning, that this is Sunday, and there's something about Sunday still, whether we're in Epoch A or Epoch B, that brings us to certain forms of reflection. And I would like to begin by drawing upon my Buddhist background and cite a scriptural quote. Okay, that should be our takeoff point for this evening. I'm quoting a man named Jamgun Kantrol, sometimes known as Jamgun Kantrol the Great, a 19th century Tibetan scholar who did a tremendous amount to synthesize, after many centuries, the various schools of thought that had developed in Tibet since the introduction of Buddhism. That's Jamgun Kantrol the Great. The statement, or the scriptural line, is that when evil conditions fill the animate and the inanimate universes, change bad conditions to the Bodhi path. Okay. When evil conditions fill the animate and inanimate universes, change bad conditions to the Bodhi path. Now, Jamgun Kantrol was not a dualist, and perhaps the use of the word evil may be somewhat misleading, and so I think we'll just digress there for a minute. In a Buddhist context, evil, the idea that evil filling the animate and the inanimate universe, is another way of saying that would be when the world is filled too much with talk and with addictions, addicting emotions. There's two basic evils or sources of ignorance or manifestations of ignorance. One is over-reliance on discursive thinking, and very much related to that is the what are spoken of as defiling emotions, the addictions that we have touched upon in several of the talks already. So the idea there is that when the universe is filled with babble and we can't control our addictions, that we find we can become ever more addicted, whether it's carbon paper or Trident or whatever the case may be, cigarettes, coffee, etc., that one is to change these conditions to the Bodhi path. Now, the Bodhi path is a peculiarly Buddhist phrase that means, in another way, maybe making it more clear for you, the ongoing path of awakening or of enlightenment or of greater awareness. Okay. This, and to me, forms the essence. It's a very personal type of responsibility that each of us has. When all of the philosophical dust and everything kind of settles, there's a very, whether we're going to go into Epoch B, or whether we're going to really transform into a planetary global culture, it's ultimately a personal responsibility, and it's the personal responsibility of becoming more awake and more aware of following a particular path of awakening or awareness. This transformation, which is implied by changing bad conditions to the Bodhi path, is also what I mean in my most recent book, The Transformative Vision. The transformative vision is the ability to see that, first of all, that there is this particular kind of condition, discursive thought, addicting emotions, whatever, and then the ability to feel that personal responsibility of changing them, of transforming them. I'd like to skip over to the new world now. One of the most illustrious and far-seeing of recent Hopi medicine men is a man named Dan Kachongva. And a little publication that was put out by bless you, Jonas. A group affiliated with the Hopis several years ago, a little booklet called the Road to Purification, The Beginning of the World and the Road to Purification. Dan Kachongva retells certain part of the creation myth of the Hopi. And the part that he retells, he speaks of the fact that at the beginning the Creator made human beings of two principles, a good principle more or less, or an evil principle. Again, that's maybe an oversimplification, but just bear with it for a moment. The left side, and this came out in the partition of the body, the left side of the body was awkward but wise. It's wise because the heart is located on the left side of the body. The right side of the body is clever and strong, and when it's divorced from the left side of the body, then it becomes evil. And I think that besides the interesting insight this throws on the high incidence of heart disease and heart attacks in our civilization, that you can also relate this to, very interestingly, and here's a very interesting way that how a mythic concept interlocks with some of our more recent modern scientific concepts, that of what we're beginning to understand about the cerebral hemispheres. And this relates very much to that, that the left side of the body is controlled by the right cerebral hemisphere, which is noted for intuitive, holistic type of perception or thinking, and the right side of the body is associated with the left hemisphere, which should be associated with logical, linear, rational, analytical, mathematical type of thinking. And that's very interesting that those hemispheres cross over and you get that type of crossover with the body. In Buddhist terms, to use a word that Gregory used yesterday, the right hemisphere relating to the left side of the body might be spoken of as that prajna, which literally is a feminine form, feminine noun, which generally is translated to mean wisdom, basic intuitive wisdom. The left hemisphere relating to the right side of the body, we could relate to the Buddhist concept of upaya, which is skillful means, the ability to do something. In the ideal condition, or the point of following the Bodhi path or becoming enlightened, is to arrive at such a condition where there is a continual dance and play of prajna and upaya. In certain of the Buddhist images, you will see the primordial Buddhas seated on a lotus throne with the hands crossed like this. In the left hand is a bell, and in the right hand is a vajra scepter. The bell, which I like that we ring bells here all the time, the bell signifies wisdom or prajna, and the vajra scepter signifies skillful means or upaya. And it's interesting that the images, the hands are crossed. So you get this sense of the integration, that there's that enlightenment is this play of prajna and upaya, of both of our hemispheres, of the two sides of our body, that they're integrated. In my book, The Transformative Vision, I introduce these terms, which may also very directly relate to the prajna and to the upaya. To these terms, psyche and techne, to relate to these two sides of our nature. Psyche is a word that's been generally used in our culture, usually rather vaguely, but it would refer to that whole complex of qualities that we mean by prajna or by intuitive wisdom, that this is that when we're talking about getting in touch with our psyche, this is what we're talking about, that we're talking about getting in touch with our basic intuitive ground. Psyche is primary. In other words, if you want to do something, you have to know, and knowing is primary. It really, in terms of intelligent behavior in any case, knowing precedes activity. Techne is the word that I've used, which would correspond to upaya, which would mean the ability to do things, skill and means. Okay. So the two sides of our nature we could see as being psyche and techne. And when we speak of integration, if you wanted to use a fancy PhD type of term, you could say that an integrated person has attained a state of, say, conscious psychotechnical integration, or is operating an undifferentiated psychotechnical continuum, and that's strictly thrown out for people who like words. That seems to be a very large part of this conference. Another way, well, several things from this. First, when I had first started reflecting in this particular manner, it occurred to me that you could view all of our development or all of history in more or less as degrees of perturbation or harmony or equilibrium or disequilibrium between our psyche and our techne. Okay? In other words, like in an integrated social condition where you have a real interplay between these two aspects of our being, you're living, say, in what we might speak of as a mythic space. We might even say that before the fall, to use a mythic term, that we're dealing with at least an undifferentiated psychotechnical type of condition. Degrees of perturbation, where there's imbalances, create the processes that we know of as history. Now, when we look at the whole, say, spectrum of history, say, since the end of the last glaciation, for a nice demarcation point, around 10,000 BC, we see a very slow and inexorable tendency that gradually escalates so that we end up with a technical dominance over psyche. As a matter of fact, the period of modern history, or history proper, is a period in which we could say that we are living in a left hemisphere tyranny. Okay. In other words, that we're dealing with a very strong emphasis on technique and on technical dominance, and an equal sense of repressing the wisdom or the psychic aspect of our nature. This is just a very general tendency. Now, these terms are really reflections of our own body makeup. And in a sense, what we speak of as history are the representations that we take to be history are really projections of our own body makeup. If we're in a generally inharmonious condition, then that is what really is reflected in the process of history. Now, our bodies, ourselves as organisms, belong to the realm of biology, at least. And we know that there is, and to the world of greater nature. And so we see that there is, among other things, a principle of periodicity that is involved in nature. And in a sense, there's a kind of a cyclical aspect to this periodicity that also applies to our own being. We could even see what kind of forms do our bodies make. Okay, when we move or when we dance, we're dealing almost all the time with variations of circular types of forms or motions. That's just a very basic kind of level that we're dealing, that inherent in our system is a built-in, as it were, a sense of periodicity and a sense of cycle and a sense of almost of circularity. Now, when we speak of, and this is just a speculation, of this process of history as being a reflection of the perturbations in our own dual nature. That, and it's been an idea, a concept, maybe a truth, that has long been in usage in earlier civilizations, is that we operate in cycles as well, in large cycles of time. So that even the historical phase of our development is an aspect of a larger mythical type of cycle. Okay. And that cycle at one point completes itself, and another type of cycle begins. In other words, like in the Hindu and Buddhist, as well as in the ancient Mediterranean traditions, you have the idea of the four ages, of the Golden Age and the Silver Age and the Bronze Age, and the Iron Age, or in the Hindu-Buddhist tradition, the Satyuga, the Dwapara Yuga, the Treta Yuga, and the dreaded Kali Yuga. Now, the Kali Yuga generally is the yuga that we happen to be living in. That's by general consent, and I think also by experience, this seems to be true. Now, an interesting thing about this cycle is that it also relates to this process of going from a more or less undifferentiated psychotechnical continuum to a situation in which there is an overwhelming technical dominance, is that these ages, at least in the Hindu tradition, have a ratio of 43 to 2 to 1. In other words, like the Golden Age is 4 and the Iron Age of the Kali Yuga is 1. What that means is that in the Golden Age, there's a lot more time to do a lot less or maybe even nothing. Whereas in the Iron Age of the Kali Yuga, there's a lot less time to do a lot more. In other words, one of the axioms of the age slowly comes to be speed kills. Okay? Because the whole process just inexorably speeds up to that point. So we live in an age of constant change and of constant motion. But this is a very quality of our age, which also, according to certain mythical and philosophical traditions of ancient civilizations, is also the very means by which this age will be transcended or this age will be transformed. Okay. We can proceed to the art historical, visual, what were the phrases used? Shimmering images, right, Bill? Okay. Okay, now. Yeah, well, I think so. We always begin with the great white light, so. Well, try it and see what happens, okay? Okay. No. No. Oh, good. You have given me the opportunity to play one of my favorite roles, one that I really try to keep in my back pocket, and that's the role of the absent-minded professor. Okay? So if you don't mind, I will take 2 minutes, go to cabin 3. We have, in earlier ages, by common consent, we recognize that there are cultures, or what I prefer to think of as art holes, in which we have these examples of perfectly integrated monuments. In other words, like the mosque here on the right, which is in Isfahan, and Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, are not merely works of art. That to call them works of art is really something of an insult, because going into these types of works is much more. There's science, there's mathematics, there's the whole summation of a particular cultural attitude that has gone into these kinds of works. And we're dealing here with sacred art. These works also appear at the very tail end of the last phase in human history, when objects of sacred art on this scale, generally speaking, could be created. That is to say, in the very late, what we call the very late Middle Ages, in the 15th, 16th century. Okay, now here's some images. Now I am tripping over myself. That also occur in this very late phase of, in which it's still possible to come up with these great psychotechnical objects, sacred art. This is a very famous monument, the so-called Aztec sunstone, which has on it the entire calendrical wisdom of the ancient Mexicans. This was executed in the 15th century, in the late 15th century, for one of the Aztec emperors. And in it, you have here the image of the four worlds, or the four ages, 1, 2, 3, 4. In addition, the ancient Mexicans believed that we are living in the fifth age, the age of the center. The fifth age isn't necessarily an additional age, but rather, in other words, like in terms of adding on time here, but rather refers to a particular kind of psychological quality that governs the general tendencies of, say, the latter part of the fourth age. The fifth age is also very neatly summed up in this symbol here, which is also, it's like a yin-yang symbol. These two parts coming like that, which also symbolizes in the ancient Mexican system the concept of motion or change. For the ancient Mexicans, the basic quality that characterizes the fifth age is rapidly accelerating change, and each of the previous ages comes to an end by the quality that most characterizes it, whether it's fire or earth or air or water. The fifth age comes to an end by change itself, by just the sheer motion, the sheer momentum of change transforms that age. So that is symbolized. This is the somewhat, this face here represents the sun of the fifth age, S-U-N, which finally devours. This is the image of all-devouring change. Now this, it's very appropriate justice that you can find this image, say, once upon a time, sacred image with all the knowledge that it contains in it, it's the trademark of Montezuma Tequila. Okay, so that's an appropriate end for that particular symbol. Over here is a 14th century French illuminated manuscript, and you can see, although very different style and so on, that you have an angel here and an angel here. The idea of change is also operating in this culture. Okay? Change is recognized by the cultures of the New World, and change in the form of mechanical motion was conceived both by the Islamic civilization as well as by the European Christian civilization. And here you have a very beautiful mandalic image of these two angels, and they're moving the universe. And the universe already in this 14th century, French manuscript is conceived of as this mechanical process operated by these angels on the outside. An idea that goes through certain permutations and resurfaces in the 17th century when mechanistic philosophy first comes into its own. Go to the next, please. Okay, here we'll have to do some shifting, and there we go. Thank you. Okay. These works don't need too much introduction. This is the famous School of Athens that was done by Raphael in the early 16th century. In one single work, Raphael presents the complete paradigm of Western thought for the next four centuries. The concept of the Cartesian coordinates is brought into it through the development of the linear one-point perspective. So you see all of this, all these lines here leading up to this central vanishing point. The vanishing point happens to be between Aristotle and Plato, who then become the fountainheads and the final recourse of humanistic philosophical thought in the West for the next four centuries. They are walking down this absolutely sheer fantasy of what the academy looked like in Athens. Barrel vaulting and domes like that actually didn't exist architecturally in Athens at that time, so this is just a sheer fantasy. There are no women in this picture. You have a, with the technical dominance and left hemisphere tyranny, as it were, you also have a tremendous downplaying of, not only of woman, but of the whole concept and the role of the feminine. So that this is a purely masculine fantasy. It's a totally man-made environment. The only glimpses you get of man's relationship to nature are these couple little vistas through the back here with some clouds and sky. At the same time, that Raphael was summing up and really presenting a forevision of the whole visual, perceptual, philosophical basis of Western thought. Hieronymus Bosch was, on the one hand, presenting maybe a final sacred image, the so-called Garden of Earthly Delights, but it's a very interesting sacred image. It's one of those sacred images that orthodox art historians like H.W. Janson don't know what to do with. At best, some of the art historians say, well, this really relates to the world before the flood. Here you have the creation. Can this be focused at all? Maybe we'll have to focus again for there, but we can focus on the, right, there we go. You have the image of Christ as the creator. And again, on his left side is Eve, which would relate to Prajna, which would relate to the feminine principle. And on the right side is Adam in this very gorgeous, very organic type of landscape. This, the most interesting part, or seems to be like the center section in which everybody is doing it with everybody, and everything is doing it with everybody, and everybody is doing it with everything. In other words, if strawberries is your predilection, make it with a strawberry. Okay, now this represents what to me the best description of Norman O'Brown's concept of polymorphous perversity. This is like the world, the undifferentiated psycho-technical continuum. This is the world before the fall, where there's just this complete liberality and freedom. There is architecture here, it's interesting, but it's extremely organic architecture. It's very much related to natural forms, very much integrated with the natural forms, as opposed to the architecture that you see in Raphael's painting. And of course, over here, then you have the whole other side of the coin. If this is the world before the fall, and this is the world of the creation and of the integrated sensory condition, then this is the world of hell. This is the world of history. Mircea Eliade said that history is terror. It's a very simple definition, which is also a more negative point of view on what the final age or the historical age of the Kali Yuga is, but definitely it's a prophetic, very disturbing prophetic type of fantasy. It's interesting that the people are being done in by their sense organs. We talked about addictions. So people, if you're addicted to music, then you get crucified on a harp. Okay. Whatever your particular addiction happens to be, that's what crucifies you. That's what the vision is here. That's what makes this particular age evil or a hell. I'm really having a hell of a time with this. There we go. And of course, the vision of the cities, for us, the cities being bombed at night, also shows the whole conflict value situation that develops once you have this basic schizophrenic split really becoming manifest in our nature. In a sense, visionaries are like the, in a historical, late historical phase, visionaries are like the people who manage to stay in touch with the auto-regulative mechanism of the evolutionary imperative, okay? That they see that this thing has to stabilize out, and what looks like visions to us is really their response to the excesses or the necessity to stabilize out. Do we have the... Right, so we have the development of what we call the humanist approach. Michelangelo's David is very strong emphasis on the physical material body, dealing in these neoclassical forms. There's a whole mystique that's built up about the rationalism of classical antiquity and so on. But if you were to take the beautiful marble flesh off David, you'd see the other aspect of the vision that develops at the time of the Renaissance, and it's this. This is a 17th century anatomical drawing. Now we know that Descartes had a very difficult time finding, once people started taking human bodies apart like this and analyzing them and labeling them, that Descartes had a very difficult time finding where to put the soul. Because he was already operating on a materialist, purely materialist type and dualistic type of assumption. We have the next. On the one hand, it's interesting that the artists are the ones who really take the lead and articulate the whole later developments of science and dialectical thought. Vermeer, already in the 17th century, perfected the one-point visual illusionism that Raphael and his generation began with to an exquisite degree, so that the only further improvement on Vermeer in the 17th century was the invention of photography in the 19th century. And I suggest that from a future point of view, that much of the history of art, Western art, between Vermeer and the invention of photography is highly uninteresting. One other thing that comes out in the image of Vermeer is that you're dealing with individual, with privacy, with ineffable little moments. It's interesting that you're dealing with a woman, member of the new bourgeois class in Holland, the new literate class, reading a letter. Okay, and it's this whole sense of privacy, of intimacy, of individuality, and even of anonymity. A contemporary Islamic image and Islamic culture up into the, at least Persian Islamic culture, up to the middle of the 17th century had resisted the new technical devices of Western European art, and you still get, as a contrast, an image of sacred art. And of course, because we've been conditioned by this perception, this looks archaic to us. Okay? It's flat. That's because it is flat. The whole Persian sacred aesthetic respected the flat two-dimensional plane that the image was occurring on, and within it worked with certain geometrical types of motifs are worked in here, which the initiated can read. But it's a very different type of situation, and this helps illustrate the difference of the two worlds that develop once the technical dominance that becomes manifest in Europe at the time of the Renaissance really begins to take over. Yes. One other development that takes place is at the same time, we know in the 16th and 17th centuries is really the high point of Western alchemy. It's also the beginning point of what we speak of as Western science, and it's very often it's a common type of notion to say that Western science really develops from alchemy, and that once the chemists got together the principles of the scientific method, they really could move away from alchemy, which is really very misleading in many ways. I'm not saying whether that's true, false, or anything. That's just the attitude that is general in speaking about this. This is a cosmic furnace. This is a 17th century alchemical drawing. And of course, the alchemists were not just working with nature, they were also working with their own psyche, which is really the difference between alchemy and science. It's not that, in other words, like, one could still today be what we would call a scientist and at the same time be an alchemist. I don't think there's any problem there. It's just the way the bias, the technical bias, develops. So in place of the cosmic furnace, we have this extremely technical utilitarian development that in some ways is parallel and in some ways develops from alchemy, which we get when we get involved in the steam engine. And of course here, this drawing for the steam engine, an 18th century drawing, is extremely precise. It's what we come to expect from real rational blueprint type of thinking, whereas the cosmic furnace still has this almost an aesthetic component, we might say, in terms of the way it's presented. You're dealing not only with the device, but with a symbolic device. Okay. Of course, another approach to this is that science, as we know it today, is alchemy without soul. And alchemy without soul, and this was a myth that was very quickly perceived in the late 18th century, especially by people like William Blake. Alchemy without soul, an ancient tradition for describing, say, any kind of soulless activity or science was the image of Moloch, or the Leviathan, or Mammon. And this is Mammon, 17th century print of Mammon, the furnace of Mammon. And the idea here is that rather than when you have a science or a technique without soul, rather than the technique being for human beings are fed into the technique. And so you have this tremendous furnace image, and the idea you can with your own imaginations supply the bodies going into that particular furnace. Well, a visionary like Blake, and actually I would have to take back my statement about art history. Blake comes between Vermeer and photography, and I'll have to renege on that one a little bit. A visionary like Blake perceived this very acutely, and probably more acutely than anyone in the last several hundred years. We might envision this particular image of Blake's here of the imagination confined by the bounds of reason and materiality. Okay, this might be what the person who's in here looks like when he's being cooked. But what that also represents is and Blake was very concerned with this, was the rational circumscribing the imaginative or the psychic until it became a very compressed and prison-like condition. In other words, this would correspond in some way to what I've spoken of as the left hemisphere tyranny over the right hemisphere. But Blake was also a whole person, a whole seer. And on the one hand, where he saw Newton at the bottom of the sea, and Newton for him represented the extreme bound of materialism, Newton was one of the villains at one level that had created the kind of situation that he saw in the rapidly industrializing England of his time. On the other hand, since he was whole, he also had a place for Newton in his own angelic pantheon, because he also saw that Newton is an instrument of the divine, and even though Newton is at the bottom of the sea of materialism, trying to define the infinite with the compass of the finite, there's this symbol of the scroll of the infinite unfolding, and that Newton had a role in an infinite unfolding process that might not be perceivable to a person with a purely materialistic perception, but to someone with a more holistic perception, it would be totally different. And so Blake's vision, very strong in his imagery, is the sense of spirals of what you see down there. And you see in this beautiful image of Jacob's ladder, of this sense of that evolutionary as a spiraling process. Of course, here we could even go back to, say, something like the DNA image. But that, and this also, the spiral, would also relate to the cyclical process that I spoke of earlier. Go ahead, the next ones. Another visionary, after photography, we could maybe divide before photography and after photography, Paul Gauguin. Now, Paul Gauguin perceives his situation in the late 19th century of extremely industrialized and nationalized technological civilization. He felt that the situation so acutely, of course, that he fled and became Anthony Quinn in a movie and a character in a novel by Somerset Maugham. But besides that, there was a certain other quality to Paul Gauguin, that he perceived that there was something that obviously the civilization, as it was going on this purely technical, rational basis, was extremely destructive to people's creativity, to people's imagination, very much like Blake. One other component in Gauguin's vision, though, is the seeking out of the non-Western archaic, of the recognizing that this was necessary. A little known fact about Gauguin is that he was very much influenced by theosophy. The Theosophical Society had opened an office in Paris in 1883, and he apparently became very familiar with the theosophical literature, which at that time also, with the first introduction of Buddhism into France, gave his later writings and his art a very strong theosophical Buddhist type of slant. But in the South Pacific, not only did he give up his former mode of perception, but he adopted or tried to integrate with archaic and oriental forms of perception. This was his image of Teatua. Teatua is like one of the primal Polynesian deities or mythic figures. And Gauguin felt that there was a very definite relationship between Teatua and the Buddha, one of whose Sanskrit names or designations is Tathagata. And he felt he saw a relationship, some kind of verbal or linguistic relationship between the Tathagata and the Teatua of Polynesia. And so his Teatua is done in a Buddhist manner, and he, as if he sees it as the Buddha. This is the Bhumaspari Mudra. That's when the Buddha declares that the earth is my witness. When Mara, the tempter, says, "How the hell did you get to be the way you are, and how can you prove it?" And the Buddha points to the earth and says, "The earth is my witness." So he has the same mudra here, but there's this very definite sense of wanting to meld with the archaic traditions, with the oriental traditions, and also with the continuity of the esoteric Christian traditions too. In a sense, Gauguin was very much of a pioneer of what we today are now experiencing as global culture, planetary culture. Uh-huh. Right. The other side of the coin. Goya, whom Huxley described as a black visionary, a visionary for whom the truth of suffering were absolutely apparent, but the truth of the release of suffering had not yet become apparent. Okay. This is the type of person that Goya was. And of course, in his famous print of 1799, again at the very same time of the outbreak of the French revolutions and American revolution, and the Industrial Revolution is gaining its tremendous momentum, he did his famous print, "The Dream of Reason Produces Monsters." In other words, he perceived very clearly that when techne is taking over, that actually techne is asleep, because there's no real activity without wisdom. So that we're almost like in a sleepwalker's type of world, and with all these disturbing images. Now, for ourselves, it's very, Goya's prophecy is very true, and this is the classic of the unconscious symbols or images that the 20th century has released as a result of the repression of reason. I mean, this may sound really high-blown and pretentious, but it's true. It's something that's so true that we tend to maybe laugh it off. But it's very interesting, the story of King Kong, very quickly. King Kong is the ruler of a tropical island off the coast of Africa. It would be what Conrad describes as the heart of darkness. A group of Barnum and Bailey entrepreneurs go there looking for whatever the most spectacular thing is that they can find, and they hit the jackpot. They get King Kong, something never before seen in New York City. And this really epitomizes, of course, they take him to New York City, and if you remember the scene, there's a crucifixion scene where King Kong is enchained and he's groaning away there. And this really represents, like, there's the masses that have been drugged and donned into a uncreative stupor, dying for entertainment, being presented with this incredible entertainment, which is really nothing but a reflection of their own repressed creative abilities. And of course, the only connection that King Kong has with humanity really is his love affair with Fay Wray, which again is interesting that he's connected with this feminine element. This is a scene that doesn't appear in the movie. This is a publicity shot that RKO did, but I think it's just tremendous. The dream of reason, the unrepressed monsters of the psyche out, you know, just terrifying. This is the kind of the terror that somehow or other is like a subliminal type of thread through our existence, our urban technological existence. Yes. Of course, one of our problems is that since we have lost all discrimination for understanding symbols and for relating symbolically, on the one hand, I don't know how many of you people have done sitting meditation, and things. This would be a very, very grossly rationalized image of what happens in just simple sitting meditation, but this is something like it, that we're just filled with symbols that we don't relate to, that we don't understand. It's all there. It's all jogging around through our minds, but it's just a big garbage can. And of course, in some of the most basic places, we find some of the most esoteric symbols. I don't have to go too much into this, but it's there. In a sense, the crazy thing is that it's all right here. That everything that we have to deal with is here. It's a matter like of maybe taking a very, very long pause or putting a moratorium on civilization and just sorting it out and see really what it is that we are dealing with. But we're so flooded with that it just doesn't make sense to us anymore. We live in a condition, and I won't belabor this too much, a dual condition, a condition of industrial pollution and psychic anarchy. And this is Diego Rivera came to the United States in the 1930s from Mexico, and it's very strange the places where he made murals. The Ford plant in River Rouge, Rockefeller Center, but they're very vividly depicting the kind of conditions. It's just this, everything being subservient, like to this seeming order of technological industrial rationality, but all of the human impulses fundamentally subservient to that, no matter how much we put frills on it, like, you know, wage benefits and all this other stuff. Just as a comparison of, say, group activity in the Isle of Bali, the performance of the famous monkey chant, which I don't know how many of you have heard that. That's an incredible piece of human orchestration. Some 200 people are doing the chanting, and it's a very complex thing. There's all sorts of different levels of rhythm and narrative and ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-chung-chung stuff happening, and it's really a very exciting piece of music. But here you have a situation in which maybe just by contrast, where psychic anarchy is not the rule, but that there is some kind of order possible. And I don't mean to be saying that we have to choose between these two, but just presenting certain conditions. Of course, the interesting thing is how the unconscious works. That even in a condition where we have absolutely repressed our sense of feeling, our sense of psychic responsibility, our sense of wisdom and intuition, that it still manifests. We might, again, and I don't mean to be dualistic, simplistic in doing this kind of thing, but this is Borobudur in Java, an 8th century Buddhist monument. Very organic, mandalic type of image. We had this little riff this morning about hierarchy. Now, this actually is hierarchical, but by hierarchical, I wouldn't understand rule by priest, but hier, H-I-E-R, actually means sacred. It's ruled by the sacred, which is maybe later on in the historical process, priests assume for themselves the rule of the sacred and do that. But it's actually hierarchical is a very organic type of process. So you see this hierarchical construction of the Temple of Borobudur. Another beautiful mandala is the Pentagon, which is very precise and exact. And again, it's a real testimony to the endurance of archetypal thinking in the most technological minds. In other words, like, you can never really repress this stuff. I got very fascinated by this. I thought, now, who dreamed this one up? I mean, how did that get to be where it was? So I did some research. The Pentagon, there was a book written by a retired general in 1964 on the subject. And the Pentagon was conceived in the late 1930s as a means of pulling together the war effort, because everyone, at least in the government, knew that we're going to be in another war. They wanted to centralize all the war offices. So it was really, and at that time too, before World War II, the Department of Defense was not the Department of Defense. It was up front. It was the Department of War. It was after the World War II that became the Department of Defense. Anyway, but I couldn't, there was no, it wasn't clear who came up with this plan of making it this Pentagon, this five-pointed figure. And of course, the Pentagon is one of the oldest symbols in magic. It's also called a pentagol or a pentagram. And it's one other interesting thing about the Pentagon is that if you draw, in traditional magic, if you're going to use a pentagon, it's a symbol of drawing down power. Now, if you're going to draw down power for beneficent purposes, you draw the pentagram or the pentagon with the odd point to the north. If you're going to use the pentagram or the pentacle for nefarious purposes, you draw the odd point to the south, as it is in the Pentagon. It's another one of those crazy little idiosyncrasies of reality. Also, when the Pentagon was being, the first plan for the Pentagon was that it should be built high on a hill overlooking the Potomac on the Virginia side, right in front of Arlington National Cemetery. Now, the only group that protested this, very interestingly enough, was the National Council of the Arts. And they protested it bitterly and finally got the site changed, both on aesthetic and on moral purposes, to the river bottom where it is now along the Potomac. Now, the neighborhood, a whole neighborhood had to be torn out for this, but it was one of the seedier neighborhoods of Arlington, Virginia, and full of pawn shops and skid row tenement type of situation. The name of the neighborhood was Hell's Bottom. Right. Point down. Right. Okay, enough of this black magic. In the middle of all this, we have certain... I mentioned that a feature peculiar to visionaries is that somehow or other, or what defines a visionary, at least for purposes of this evening, is the ability to somehow or other get in touch with the auto-regulative or the self-regulating mechanism that governs the evolutionary imperative. In other words, that it's, you know, getting self-control, you know, at least saying to yourself, slow down, okay, or getting some kind of awareness like that. One of the places where this begins to happen is in Carl Jung. Carl Jung, interestingly enough, discovered the mandala towards the end of the First World War and worked with it very seriously for the next 10 years, at which point he had a dream, very beautiful mandalic type of a dream. And after he had this dream, he said, I knew I didn't have to paint mandalas anymore, that mandala had become the prima materia of my life work. So this is one of those situations. This is a painting by a patient of Jung's, and he also saw the value of using art, say, in the interpretation of dreams and in the interpretation of the psychic life as being a very integral aspect of it. This particular patient dreamt that this whole image appearing in the middle of this mechanized city, and I like this image because it really kind of shows this whole transformative process of in the nighttime, in the midst of the city, that this beautiful image begins to flower, this image of wholeness, of integration with nature, with the seasons, with the sexes, and so on. And of course, this led Jung also to a consideration of the relationship between that kind of image and the kind of image which is common in Tibet. This is a very fine Tibetan mandala, represents the Kala Chakra. Kala Chakra means wheel of time, is the wheel of time mandala. The Kala Chakra is the tantra of the Tibetan prophecies. Okay? The ruler of the Kala Chakra Tantra, the deity, or the Yidam, actually, deity in Tibet, deity isn't an external thing, it's an emanation of a particular psychic principle or force residing within us. The ruler of the Kala Chakra Tantra is Mahakala, the Black Lord, or the Lord of Time, who rules the Kali Yuga. So I just thought I'd introduce you to him to see... acquaint you with one of the basic forces that presides. It's a very nice, startling type of image. He's holding a skull bowl, but the skull bowl is also the symbol of the yogi's path. Okay, and he holds a skull bowl. And of course, these types of images or figures in Tibetan art have a dual role. One is to, you know, like
if this stuff isn't meant for you, you'll look at that and you'll say, this ain't meant for me. Okay. So that, in that way, that has the role of protecting the Dharma from people who wouldn't want it anyway. And the other side of it is that it does represent a psychic force and a transformation of a psychic force. Say, like, everyone has fear energy or lust or hate or murder energy, okay? And this would represent then the transformation of this type of energy so that it becomes a protective type of emanation. This is a mural in the streets of the barrio in East Los Angeles, the Chicano community. You have here images of hate, repression, war, the whole works. But very beautifully coming out of this image, you have an image of the plumed serpent of Quetzalcoatl. Now, I don't know by what, again, it's one of these things of probably as much unconscious as it is conscious, a kind of resurfacing of this. Now, in my own studies, I found a very interesting coincidence between the Tibetan Kala Chakra, which is the teaching of time and the prophecies of time, and the prophecies of Quetzalcoatl and of the ancient Mexicans. The Kala Chakra system is as far as it's a calendar system, operates in 60-year cycles. The first, the Tibetans began keeping this in 1027. The last cycle began in 1927, which was, interestingly enough, also the date that Evans Wentz brought out the Tibetan Book of the Dead. This cycle comes to an end in 1987. Now, this also corresponds to certain of the prophecies of Quetzalcoatl. That calendar system was running on a 52-year cycle. And particularly the esoteric system relating to Quetzalcoatl, that also ends in the year 1987. Could I have the... So those kinds of endings, this is a beautiful Aztec sculpture. The Aztecs were very interesting schizophrenic people. The more I've studied them, the more I realized that they were the Americans of ancient Mexico. They did to the ancient Mexicans exactly what we did to North America. And they had the same schizophrenic relationship to their religion. To say that the ancient human sacrifices of the Aztecs had a direct relationship, say, to the religion of Quetzalcoatl is to say that the bombing of Hanoi was a direct result of the Sermon on the Mount. Okay, so that's how we all have these schizophrenias. This is a beautiful Aztec sculpture of Quetzalcoatl, like in the Hindu Kundalini image, serpent coiled around 3.5 times, and then emerging from the mouth of this plumed serpent, which of course represents the opposites, is the image of the full human being slowly emerging from there. Of course, in the ancient Mexican prophecies, that the end of the fifth age will really be the emergence of a really fully potential realized humanity. Whether that's pie in the sky, I don't know. This also relates to another image, a Western image, that of the Ouroboros. That, like, when we're talking about these cycles of time, that we come to a point where the circle completes itself. And it's not that we go back and we're back in the Stone Ages again necessarily, but we're dealing more with a spiral type of motif. But we are dealing with the serpent biting its own tail. When it bites its tail, it releases a poison which is homeopathically effective in curing itself. And the Pythagorean tradition, it said that the person who does not know how to join the beginning of the circle with the end knows only death. So it's very important to join the beginning with the end. We've talked about irreversible effects, and I think I'll just remind us of one of the irreversible social changes. This is my wife and I, when we were at the Evergreen State College, were in a very strange situation. I was the coordinator of an arts program, and The interesting thing was that there were no ARC facilities. And so we had to make do. And so for a painting studio, we transformed a four-story stairwell into a mural. And we designed the mural so that it went through the different elements, earth, air, fire, and water. And at every landing, we would have a transformation. And the motif would be like of an earth dragon and a fire dragon and so on. We'd have a point of transformation. This is the landing. Well, if you're up here and you're coming down from the president's office from the fourth floor and you're down to the third floor, this is what you see. And this is a transformation between air, see the head of the air dragon, and fire. You see the tail of the fire dragon here. And the only appropriate thing we could think of, thumbing idly through a Life magazine, which had glorious photographs of French hydrogen bomb tests in the South Pacific, was this image, this transformation. On the one hand, it's irreversible, but just some kind of instinct also told us that it was also like a sign of the phoenix, that it was, because it was irreversible, it was like that, the release of the poison when the Ouroboros bites its tail. Okay? And that release of the poison then creates the possibility of a rebirth, of a risen phoenix. This is a mandalic image that I thought looked nice with this, if you're talking about atomic blasts, by a woman in San Francisco named Susan Kelk Cervantes.